When the SEC takes an enforcement action against an advisor, it is usually either through an internal administrative order or through a complaint filed with the federal district court. These accusatory documents lay out the charges the commission is bringing against the advisor, as well as the facts the SEC is using to back up its charges and the remedy the agency is seeking, or which the advisor may have already agreed to if the document is in fact a settlement. But the words chosen by the SEC attorneys for the administrative order or the court complaint, and the choices the agency makes in terms of what to include and what not to include, represent an art as well as a science. Experienced legal minds know why certain charges are sometimes paired with others, why some information may be intentionally omitted, and are able to make fairly astute judgments as to why certain sanctions are pursued while others are not. I'm Robert Sperber, editor of ACA Insight. Here to speak with us is someone with years of litigation experience defending advisors, broker-dealers, and other securities firms against SEC enforcement actions. Stern & Tanenbaum partner, Aegis Frumento. Aegis, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Bob. Pleasure to be here.
Perhaps we can start by your sharing with us what approach, what mindset, if you will, an advisor, as well as the advisor's attorney, should take when first reviewing an SEC enforcement action. What should the experienced reviewer be looking for?
Well, it's a big question. I can answer it in the sense of kind of the way I look at it. And my, as you pointed out, my background is primarily as a litigator, and I view SEC enforcement instruments. Let's call them that. Not like any written document. I mean, it's written for a purpose, and it's written with an audience in mind. And the first thing I look at is the structure of it, and that's what I would advise people to look at first. You notice, for example, that in any situation where the SEC wants to get wants attention, essentially, on what it's doing, there's always two things that come out. First is a press release, and then there is a formal document behind the press release, and these are all available on the SEC website. And so the first thing to look at, and these are layered documents, and in a sense, what the tip of the iceberg, if you will, is the quote in the press release. Every press release has a quote in the middle of it, a quote by an SEC official. And you can almost see how important the case is by seeing how high up on the SEC pecking order the person making the quote is. The quote is, in essence, a bit of a propaganda piece. It is the part that the SEC would like the news wires and some reporters who are being more casual about it to pick up and put into an article. That's the tip of the iceberg. And then around the quote there are some facts, again, crafted by the SEC to really try to emphasize the point that's made in the quote. But the real guts of the case are always going to be in the formal instrument that's behind the press release.
Okay. And how should that be read?
Well, again, it's a question of categorizing it. I mean, as you pointed out earlier, I mean, some SEC actions are settled, right from the start. And so what the SEC is essentially is announcing is both the bringing of charges and the settlement of those charges. Those settled orders, as they're called, those are negotiated instruments. They've been crafted as part of an effort by the commission and the respondents to arrive at a resolution that, from the commission's point of view, accomplishes its objective, and from the respondent's point of view, causes the least amount of harm that it can get away with. So the settled orders need to be read a little differently than non-settled orders, which are really more accusatory documents. So, for example, if the SEC has an order that begins an administrative proceeding or has filed, very rarely these days, a complaint in district court, those accusatory documents are going to be much more open textured. They're going to have a lot more in them to try to buttress whatever charges the SEC is bringing. I think as a general matter with respect to reading SEC instruments and really all legal documents is to keep in mind something that a law professor and an old mentor, hammered into me when I was a young lawyer, which is that the law follows the facts and not the other way around. It's the factual recitation that's really the key to the thing. And if the facts are laid out, ideally, if you read the facts of a situation, you ought to know what the violation is. It ought to be, especially if you know what the basics of the regulations are. If you read the facts, you ought to be able to guess what the violations are. And so to a large extent, the crafting of all of these documents really involves a laying out of a factual scenario that makes it crystal clear that there has been a violation. Anyone who's reading these things ought to read the facts very carefully, both what is said and what is not said, and put themselves in the real life, real world shoes of that particular advisor. Your readers know the business. They can imagine what it is that advisor was doing, on a day-to-day basis in running the fund. And you ought to be able to imagine yourself in that advisor's shoes and be able to some extent, live his life a little bit. And then you can start to understand what it is about the conduct that the SEC is objecting to.
Well, when I sometimes will read one of the many complaints or administrative proceedings, administrative orders, instituting proceedings, I will notice sometimes what seem like obvious omissions. For instance, there might be a reference to something being done differently or perhaps better a year before. And so you're sort of waiting to hear what was done, and they don't tell you what it was. They just say it was done better. When you see those sorts of omissions, you can't help but think that's intentionally been left out, maybe because it doesn't buttress the case strongly enough. I mean, what are the possibilities there?
Well, there are a lot of possibilities. First of all, again, you have to consider whether it's a settled order or whether it's an accusatory document.
Well, let's say it's accusatory.
If it's accusatory, then anything that's jarring, if you will, when you read the thing, it's a signal that something was left out, that there's a fact in there that is not helpful to the SEC's case. I mean, remember that the accusatory document everything is written for an audience, and the accusatory document, a complaint of whatever kind, it has an audience too. It has two audiences, actually. The first audience is the actual person to whom it's written, which is generally an administrative law judge. This is the first document that the administrative law judge will read. As an act of advocacy, the accusatory document, the complaint, is the first opportunity to condition the mind of the decision maker, right? And so you want the decision maker to read, and the SEC wants this. I would want this if I were crafting an accusatory document. I want this if I'm crafting an answer to an accusatory document. I want the administrative law judge to read the document and basically say to himself, this is a slam dunk. This is going to be an easy one. Or conversely, if they're reading an answer, to basically say, okay, looks like the SEC's out on a limb on this one. This is not going to be such an easy case. That's just basic advocacy. That is essentially trying to sort of, you don't want to say precondition, but that's the right word. Precondition the decision maker to see things your way. And so if something is missing from an accusatory document, you can guess that the reason it's missing is because it wasn't helpful.
Right. When you look at a document yourself for the first time, an accusatory document, meaning a proceeding order.
A complaint of some kind, right.
Right. Where do you turn first? Do you go to the facts first? Do you go to the summary? Do you go to the charges? Do you go?
I always go to the facts. I always go to the facts first. As I said earlier, I mean the law follows the facts. You've got to look and see what exactly is going on. The facts really are what drives everything. You know, now some facts. You know, you've got sort of, everyone has their own sort of, way of cataloging things, I suppose. I mean, but my own preferred way, especially, and also these ways, they change over time as issues tend to change. I mean, but looking in the past, say, 24 months, and looking at the sorts of cases that have come out of the SEC relating to, you know, hedge funds and investment advisors over the past 48 months, really. What you see is really three kinds of cases. The first are the simple cases, what I call the simple cases. And here, you know, is the typical Ponzi scheme where you read the press release. You don't even have to read the accusatory document. You read the press release and you see that you have an advisor who's basically, you know, selling investments to investors, and instead of investing the money, takes the money for himself and pays off for his BMW. Well, that's sort of a slam dunk. I mean, that's easy. Anybody can read something like that and see that there's been a violation. So you don't learn very much from those kinds of cases other than, you know, don't do it. And if you didn't know that from the beginning, then you're in the wrong business. The second kind is more complex, what I call complex operational cases. And what we've been seeing in the past 48 months really is cases involving, for example, expense allocations, valuations of investments, conflicts of interest, not obvious conflicts of interest, but sort of, you know, inherent, underlying conflicts of interest. These are more problematic because it's not exactly clear necessarily that there have been actual violations. And the reason for that is because they depend on facts which are a little softer. They depend, for example, on questions of whether there was proper authority, whether there was sufficient disclosure. And whenever you say, you sort of qualify those words with, you know, things like proper or adequate or sufficient, well, that's you're almost always bringing into play a judgment call. And so Consequently, those kinds of cases are harder. They're more nuanced. They're not necessarily slam dunks. And then the third category is almost a tag-along. It's really what I call the technical violations. And I'm thinking particularly of those cases that raised custody rule issues or compliance policy violations. They often, they're seldom brought independently, and they're almost always brought in conjunction with some other violation. You know, it's almost a joke that any violation of a substantive rule almost carries a compliance policy violation along with it, because you can almost argue that whenever there's been a violation of a substantive rule, it implies that there hasn't been, you know, that the compliance policies were inadequate, because if they were adequate, they would have prevented that rule from being violated. So it's almost a joke, But those are kind of sort of the three broad categories, especially when we're talking in the investment advisor world, of violations that you tend to see.
Okay. And going along with that, have there been specific cases where you've noticed how one case informs another case in terms of how?
Well, you raise a good point, and it's also something to keep in mind when reading cases, and that is that when you dip into a case, very often you're stepping into the middle of a conversation. There's a dialogue going on. I mean, the SEC is an enforcement agency, and it's got a job to do, which is to not only to enforce the securities laws, but also to make sense of them, to enforce them not only in the sense of individual violations, but also in the sense of sort of building up a policy regime around it. And so you very often we'll see cases that build on other cases that build on other things that the SEC has done. For example, at the beginning of 2014, the SEC announced, you know, an enforcement initiative for private equity funds and hedge funds relating to expense allocations. I mean, they, you know, made a public statement, public, you know, program that that they were going to look. They were looking. That was the enforcement. You know, that was the enforcement emphasis du jour was expense allocations. So within a month, they brought a case which I worked on last year involving expense allocations, and so that case wended its way through and was eventually, you know, settled mid last year. You know, after some back and forth before the administrative law judge, and in the aftermath, other cases have been brought. Very recently, a case was brought, I think, just last month, by the SEC, which was settled on the spot. In which, you know, when you read that case, you can see the issues that arose in the prior case somehow being dealt with differently and more effectively in the latter case.
And
right?
That is so, definitely intentional on the part of the SEC. I mean, we can be sure they were acutely aware of the previous case.
We kind of know they were in this one because it came out of the same office, right? In the same and it's almost the same staff dealing with it. But the fact of the matter is that what you're seeing is an evolutionary process, and you know, to us lawyers, especially litigators, this is not an uncommon thing. The concept of the common law of cases sort of developing by experience is a very old and venerable tradition in American and British jurisprudence. And so what you're seeing is a similar thing happening on a smaller scale. So when you say is it intentional, it's almost kind of the wrong question. It has to happen this way. This is the natural evolution of the process. You always take the experience of the past case and bring it into the future case. And so there's nothing untoward about it, all right? But it's important to keep in mind when you're looking and you're reading a case that's coming down the pike that very little stands in isolation. There's always a context. There's always a background, you know, a background discussion that's taking place. And when you're talking, for example, about the complex cases, the expense allocation type of cases, and the conflict of interest type of cases that these cases involve, it's not only one case learning from another case, but it's also the developing policy discussion and debate, that surrounds it. The expense allocation cases, to a large extent, result from a tension that exists and has not been resolved, and really I don't think will be resolved unless and until Congress, you know, makes some revisions to the Advisors Act. But there's a tension between, you know, the governance principles and permissions given by state law that runs the limited partnerships that are the funds, and the fiduciary obligation that impose their own fiduciary obligations on fund managers, and the SEC's version of fiduciary obligations and disclosures that come out of the Advisors Act. And it's not at all clear how that gets resolved. All that's clear right now is that those two strands of the law are a bit in tension. They're pressing against each other. And a lot of these cases are efforts by the SEC to try to navigate between those two branches of the law.
You know, sometimes when I look at an accusatory document, I notice that some parties are not named. Like they'll name the firm, they'll name the CEO, they'll name the CCO, but they won't name X person, some title. It could be a portfolio manager, it could be somebody else on compliance staff. And you sort of have to wonder, why is that? Is that the person who came to the SEC? Is there some other reason? Was it not helpful to the SEC's case to name them? How do you read that sort of thing?
I think your last answer is probably the most generally correct. It just wasn't helpful to name them. And the thing to keep in mind is, especially when you're talking about accusatory documents, is that you don't want to overreach. Remember that, you know, this is the instrument that you're putting in front of the administrative law judge to convince the administrative law judge that you've got a good case. Well, primary rule of any advocacy is that your own credibility as an advocate is one of the key things that is at play. You don't want to blow that. And you can blow your credibility as an advocate by overreaching, by naming people against whom you have a weak case. You know, when I look at cases as a defense lawyer, I always try to look for the weak spot. I look for the place where not only the commission but any adversary has overstepped, has overreached, has gone a bridge too far, because that generally is the place where you can hammer home, you can hammer at the credibility of your adversary. That's the place where your adversary is vulnerable. And so if you're smart in drafting an accusatory document, you will stick to your strongest arguments and go after your weakest opponents. So I think the simple answer really is that it just wasn't helpful to the commission's case. Why it wasn't helpful, you may not be able to figure that out. You know, on the other hand, you may very well be able to figure it out. You know, if there's enough facts in the accusatory document, and you as a reader are imaginative enough to be able to put yourself in the shoes of the people that they're talking about, you might very well be able to see why it is that a certain person wasn't named.
Well, that is very interesting. Aegis, thank you very much for providing your insights on how to read an SEC enforcement action. I'm ACA Insight Editor Robert Sperber. Our guest has been Stern & Tanenbaum law firm partner, Aegis Frumento. Thanks for listening.